Before we dive into this episode of HRD Masterclass, I'd like to take 30 seconds to share the exciting news that we're now seeking sponsors for Season 5 to release in 2024. This is a wonderful opportunity to support the podcast series and also share your message with 3,500 HRD listeners around the world. Sponsorship options cost just $750 and $600 per episode, and for full details, contact DARREN at allbypodcast.com. Right, let's start the episode. Welcome to Human Resource Development Masterclass, the new podcast series from the Academy of Human Resource Development, the organization that leads HRD through research. I'm your host, Darren Short, and throughout this first series, I've been joined by leading authors, researchers, and scholars to explore the fundamentals of HRD and how those are changing in the 2020s. Now we've reached the final episode of this first series, I'm taking the opportunity to reflect back on what we've learned and what questions we've surfaced to carry forward to the second series, which releases later this year. Over the next hour, I'm going to share what I've learned about the fundamentals of HRD, and as I do that, I'm going to share some extracts of the conversations I've had with guests. I'm also going to spotlight a few of the conversations that I find myself going back to over and over again. This episode is brought to you thanks to the generous support of our episode sponsor, Interpretive Simulations. Find out more about their services at interpretive.com. Right, let's dive into the episode. It's been a real honor to host this first series and to meet with people who are so passionate about understanding and improving HRD. So as I look back now over the first 10 episodes, what did I learn about the fundamentals of HRD? Well, I came away from the series focusing on 10 themes that in different ways cut across the episodes, and I'm going to explore a little of each of them over the next hour. The 10 are how we define ourselves, responding to the changing workplace, the shifting balance between organizational and individual responsibility, changes to how people learn, advocating for social justice, working across cultures, being strategic, demonstrating our worth, how HRD works through and with others, and finally, the gap between HRD research and practice. So let's start with theme one, how we define ourselves. And I'd like to kick off, as indeed I will with each of the 10 themes, by playing a short extract from a conversation. So let's hear first from Richard Swanson from episode 1 on the history and foundation of HRD.
As you might expect, having definitions is really important in terms of foundations. And there are a whole range. There are actually some journal articles that just review all the different definitions of human resource development. And there, again, there are differences, and they're more alike than they are unalike. But coming together with definitions that are understood and acceptable to large groups of people is really important.
I don't know if people in other professions find it easy to define their profession or to describe it to friends and family. It's something I've struggled with for the 29 years that I've worked in HRD. Over that time, there have just been so many different labels for the profession and different job titles that people work under. And that was reflected in the 9 definitions of HRD that appeared in this first series. For those who are seeking clarity and certainty, then perhaps the 9 are something of a problem. However, for me, they're symptomatic of one of the most significant things that I learned about the fundamentals of HRD, which is that HRD is this wonderful potpourri, a blend of people and topics that have enough in common that there are clear connections and threads between them. But there are also enough differences that not everything fits perfectly. And as a result, this first series bumped occasionally into perspectives and viewpoints that simply didn't quite align. And for me, that potpourri is part of what makes HRD so intriguing. That we can bring together those who are passionate about creating cultures for individuals to learn with those who are passionate about improving performance of teams, with those who are passionate about developing careers in organizations, and with those who are passionate about changing organizations and society for the better. We can also bring those with deep expertise in strategy, together with people whose expertise is in working across cultures or in evaluation. Wherever we look in HRD, we see a diverse range of interests and experiences within people who share enough of a passion for learning and performance that they can work together and can learn from each other in this large, welcoming tent that we'll call HRD. And at that point, I should probably apologize for mixing my metaphors of potpourri and large tents. So thank you for working with me through that. Across the series, we heard examples of a breadth and a depth of HRD as guests talked about different HRD activities that improve individuals through coaching, improving teams, improving the effectiveness and efficiency of processes, improving the performance of organizations to the benefit of employees and customers, and then, as we heard from Gary McLean in episode 3, even how HRD can improve societies in the form of initiatives to address child labor and turn around communities that are struggling. We also heard about the breadth and the depth of the expertise that HRD professionals need to undertake this work. So we have diagnostics, design and delivery, facilitation, problem solving, solution generation. We have relationship building, data analytics, sense making, questioning, reflection, challenging assumptions, challenging the status quo, cultural awareness, thinking strategically. I could carry on the list for a lot longer. Another example of the breadth and the depth I talk about is in the knowledge base and the theoretical base of HRD. As we heard from Toby Egan in episode 3 about the use of systems thinking, and from Marilyn Bird in episode 7 about critical race theory and human relations, and Yunju Cho in episode 6 about tokenism, Thomas Garavan in episode 10 about human capital theory, and from Rosia Mohamed Rusty in episode 8 about the cultural frameworks of Hofstede and Trompenaars. Perhaps it's this breadth and depth that makes it challenging to define HRD, and perhaps we really don't need to. As Dick Swanson said in the excerpt I played earlier, there are lots of definitions of HRD, and they are more alike than they are unalike. Of course, having a simple and consistent way of describing ourselves could help us when talking to others, and could well make it easier for us to define the boundaries of HRD. However, I'm not at all sure it's worth the energy that it would take to create that simple, consistent way of describing ourselves. And no matter how I look at the 10 episodes, it's tough for me to listen to them without concluding that HRD has a breadth and a depth that makes it both intriguing and also tough for me to wrap my head around. It's also tough to listen to them without thinking about the wonderful potential that exists within HRD. That within this breadth and depth, there's the skill set and the mindset and the knowledge to really make a difference for the better in this world. And that's a thought I'll be returning back to when I wrap up the episode. The second theme I identified in the series was responding to a changing workplace. And to kick us off, I'd like to play a minute from my conversation with Ron Jacobs from episode 4 on training and development.
I think so. I think from an organization, you know, from a company perspective, and we're talking maybe 30 years ago, 40 years ago, the way organizations justified having a what at that time could have been called a training department or a training and development department that they justified that there was an important need for the organization, that they have some activity going on that looked like learning to support the organization in some way. And how that was actually expressed in the organization oftentimes was a great deal of variation. Some organizations were very proud of the fact that they had catalogs of courses that they offered to their employees, and you know, employees might select those courses based on their MBOs. And you know, the HRD department or the training department at that time was very happy to be complicit in all this because that gave them customers. So there was this idea, as you say, that training and development was like a little schoolhouse.
During this series, we learn that HRD is on a journey, that the HRD we see today looks very different from how it looked 20 to 30 years ago. And I've had the good fortune to watch that happen in my HRD career and to be a part of it too. Throughout the series, we heard about different workplace changes that have happened, like how organizations have become more global and more reliant on technology, and how they've responded to economic drivers to downsize or to flatten structures or to find economies of scale, and how organizations have merged or acquired each other, and then, as we heard from Kim McDonald in episode 5, how the workforce has become more diverse and how employees have changed their view of careers and career paths. Over the last 18 months, we've seen some of those changes speed up, as well as new forces come into play as a result of COVID. And as we heard from Ron Jacobs and Malika Shir Mohammadi in episode 4, one such example of that is more people who are working from home, either full-time or as a blend of remote and office work. And I think we're still seeing the effects of that playing out in the workplace today. HRD has found itself responding to those changes. As we heard from Sungwon Yoon in episode 4, we've seen HRD shifting away from a pure focus on formal training, a move towards more blended solutions, less of a focus on in-person, a greater use of technology, and much more. An in-house HRD team of 20 to 30 years ago would likely have been structured around the design and delivery of in-person training, often lengthy in nature, which were all pulled together as part of a prospectus of offerings. Whereas, as we heard in the series, today's HRD departments blend e-learning, virtual and in-person, that are often shorter in nature, such as micro-learning, and often targeted to meet specific organizational priorities, with a greater focus on strategy and on data analytics. Today's HRD function, I think, is also more likely to be a blend of in-house content and that sourced from third parties. And as we heard from Victoria Marsick in episode 2 and Toby Egan in episode 3, that outsourcing of HRD has brought its own challenges. To an extent, HRD could be said to have hurt itself by focusing on process and by hiring expertise. Essentially, as Victoria Marsick described, becoming commissioners of learning solutions, and so no longer building internal capacity, and increasingly purchasing non-customized, out-of-the-box approaches from vendors. This can make it even more challenging for HRD to demonstrate value and impact within the organization, and also to offer a career to HRD professionals who are seeking to develop as instructional designers, facilitators, and learning program managers. As we examined in the series, looking ahead to the coming years, we're likely to see HRD continuing to explore technologies through virtual realities, and as described by Malika Shir Mohammadi in episode 4, also identifying new ways of engaging learners who are working remotely and fatigued by standard virtual collaboration platforms, and then to combine all of that with a shift towards adaptive learning. Another change impacting HRD was discussed by Laura Beamer, Carol Elliott, and Tamika Greer in episode 6. And that was the potential that HRD has to step up in response to social pressures and changes, and the need to look critically at organizational systems and processes and actively advocate for social justice. Marilyn Bird, Yeonju Cho, and Torrance Sparkman then built on that within Episode 7 to provide concrete examples of actions that HRD can be taking in the area of social justice. However we look at it, the series demonstrated that the world of HRD is ever-changing. Partly driven by the forces of the workplace, and I think partly driven by our own desire to leverage new technologies, add more value, and be better at what we do. I'm sure that the changes I've seen over the last 30 years in HRD will be equaled, if not surpassed, by those that will happen in the next 30 years. The third theme I identified from the 10 episodes was the shifting balance between organizational and individual responsibility. And here's an extract taken from my conversation with Raji Ghosh from Episode 5 on career development.
It's not completely employee-oriented career in organizations. It's somewhat blended. And what I mean by that is that organizations are definitely encouraging or wanting their employees to be more self-directed in terms of managing their career, but they too have a vested interest. So, you know, I would argue that we are somewhat, if you think about this as a continuum from employer oriented to employee, we are somewhere in the middle in terms of having a blended perspective on how employees' careers should be managed.
The topic of the shift between organizational and individual responsibility surfaced in several episodes. And we heard perspectives on it from Linda Perriton in Episode 1, from Malika Shir Mohammadi in Episode 4, and from both Kim McDonald and Raji Ghosh in Episode 5. And it was described in maybe slightly different ways as impacting careers and career paths, as changing priorities for how and when organizations invest in employee development, and also reducing the likelihood that organizations will support employees who are looking to gain education in the form of postgraduate degrees and diplomas. In practice, we've seen a shift away from careers being viewed as occurring within a single organization, where HRD functions could then structure deliverables around long-term development pathways, and when significant amounts of energy were being directed towards planning and managing employee careers. And in its place, we now see a variety of blended forms where often individuals are viewed as owning their own careers, as having multiple careers over time, as piecing together their own career paths, and then also of managing their own learning to advance those careers. In some cases, as with the gig economy and as with the advent of zero-hour contracts, we're seeing individuals carrying the full responsibility and cost associated with their learning and development, which further challenges the role of HRD within the workplace. As we heard from examples across the series, this shift changes the way that learning is viewed within organizations and also how HRD approaches and invests in learning. For example, if an organization typically retains its employees for just 2 or 3 years, how likely is it that organization will invest in developing skills that are not immediately applied to the benefit of the organization? At the same time, if the organization doesn't invest in those employees, does that just increase the likelihood that attrition happens sooner? And with individuals increasingly viewing themselves as owning their own careers and development, how does this change the way that HRD works with employees and with managers in a form of shared responsibility, with the goal of creating learning opportunities that not only help individual employees, but also benefit the organization? In some respects, the series probably raised more questions than it answered, and that most likely reflects the shifting nature of individual responsibility in the workplace. From the conversations we had, it feels unlikely that we've seen an end to this rebalancing between individuals and organizations. And so with more changes likely to happen in the future, I see us revisiting this topic in future series. The fourth theme was that of changes to how people learn, and I'd like to play you an extract from my conversation with Malika Shirmohammadi from episode 4 on training and development.
When we think about just-in-time or on-demand learning, if there's this one thing that I want to learn and get started, if it's accessible to me, yes, let me learn it from someone who has done it before, who knows how to do it, and I'll go just learn it from them. I just need to have the resources that I need, have access and somebody to facilitate it for me to get that connection to the person who knows how to do that.
As Malika explores there, there's been a change in how people learn or in how they want to learn and also who they want to learn from. When I talk about this with colleagues, it doesn't take long before I eventually mention the analogy of my vacuum cleaner. So I'm going to share that here. So my vacuum cleaner broke and I obviously wanted to mend it. So I Googled to find out what the problem was and then I Googled again to find a YouTube video on how to solve that problem. And I went about mending the vacuum cleaner by watching a bit of the video and then copying what I'd watched and then watching a bit more of the video and then copying that. And eventually, about 25 minutes later and having worked through a couple of minutes of video, my vacuum cleaner was working again. That simple analogy, at least for me, illustrates how learning has changed over the last 20 years, that people increasingly want their learning baked into their work, so they learn what they need to complete a task as they're actually completing that task. And they want to learn it in what I'll call nuggets, so small pieces of information that they can take in quickly and copy. And they want to learn from experts, and they want to learn without leaving their desks. So to stick with the analogy and probably push it beyond where it really should have been ditched, the time I think is gone where people are willing to sit through a one-day course on everything to do with vacuum cleaners to just find the 2 minutes of information that they need. And the time has gone when people are okay learning from someone who isn't an expert on vacuum cleaners. And the time's gone when they'd be willing to wait a few weeks until a place becomes available on the next vacuum cleaner course. As a result, HRD has found itself with a number of fresh challenges, such as how to bake learning into work processes and tasks and systems and tools, and how to curate environments that allow individuals to find and learn from experts who are elsewhere in the workplace. And as Victoria Marsick and Karen Watkins talked about in episode 2, how to help employees then understand the big picture when much of the learning that they're getting is increasingly targeted and focused and micro. The evidence appears to be that the trend will continue towards even more targeted learning that's being applied straight away and is being facilitated by technology and leverages internal and external experts. As this happens, I suspect HRD will be forced to rethink its role as a content creator and to look instead to how it crafts and supports learning cultures, facilitates relationships between learners, coaches, and experts, and how it ties HRD in with knowledge management systems. This isn't to say that the more traditional aspects of HRD will go away. As Sungwon Yoon stressed when talking about the future of in-person training in episode 4. But it does look likely that we'll see a continuing shift in the balance of what learning happens, when it happens, and what form it takes. The fifth theme from the 10 episodes was that of HRD's role in advocating for social justice. And here's an extract from the conversation I had with Torrance Sparkman in episode 7 on diversity, equity, and inclusion in HRD.
Changes in our DNA learning is in our DNA, performance is in our DNA. We understand the psychology of resistance. We understand action and reaction and systems. We understand paradigms and perspectives, which help us to work with individuals, teams, organizations, and communities, and as McLean says, the whole of humanity. So the foundation is there. But for me, the question that we have to ask is, do we have the will and the confidence and the equipment to address social justice and diversity issues?
Torrance's statement there was one of several powerful ones that were made by different scholars across the series. For example, we heard from Marilyn Bird in the same episode about how learning and performance are impeded by lived experiences. And we heard from Laura Biermer in episode 6 about the important role that HRD has to look for and to challenge inequities and injustices within organizations. In the same episode, Tamika Greer talked about the need for HRD to look at organizational processes and systems to examine who has power and how that power impacts the outcome of HRD. We also heard examples of working on gender issues from Yunju Cho in episode 7 and also from Gary McLean in episode 3. When I listen back to the episodes now, I find myself increasingly focusing on the potential that HRD has to play a significant role in addressing social injustices within the workplace. And also wondering how much of that potential we actually realized to date. I wonder in how many organizations is HRD a driving force for looking critically at that organization's tools, systems, and processes? And in how many organizations is HRD sticking its head up to ask the difficult questions of company leadership? My hope is that it's in far more organizations than was the case maybe a year or two ago. And so I like to believe that we're trending in the right direction. However, I suspect that we have a ways to go, as HRD feels like it's walking this line between being a vehicle for achieving the desired outcomes of company leadership and also a vehicle for social good. Where those two are the same, or at least align sufficiently, it could be that HRD's work is naturally moving us in the right direction. But I wonder if that's where the work there is, let's say, easier. Where it feels tougher is when an organization's leadership isn't aligned with a drive for social justice, and HRD professionals therefore have to speak up and, for want of a better term, act up. As Laura Biermer talked about in episode 6, that can be as simple as asking questions. And it feels like that's a good starting point, to look critically within an organization and to surface what is currently hidden and to ask questions about why, and to take that discussion into a place of redesigning how things work. As Torrance Sparkman explored in episode 7, HRD has the potential to play a greater role. As Torrance said, we know about change, about processes, about creating spaces, about giving new tools. And it feels like we're well placed to go beyond what HRM can do in this space. But as Torrance said, we need the will, the confidence, and the equipment. As we dig deeper into this in future series, I really hope we see HRD finding that will and that confidence, and increasingly pushing for social justice in the workplace. Before we look at the remaining 5 themes of the series, I'd like to first pause and tell you about the episode's sponsors. This episode is brought to you thanks to the sponsorship support of Interpretive Simulations. Since 2008, students and trainees have used Interpretive Simulations HR Management Simulation, where participants are tasked to make challenging decisions at the HR director level in a simulated environment. Students must build a strong HR function at their simulated medium-sized organization and wrestle with the challenges of staying on budget, The simulation makes the connection between concept and practice while students learn by doing. It comes with assignments, mini cases, and quizzes to reinforce core HR principles. If you'd like to receive faculty access to review the HR management simulation, visit them at www.interpretive.com and fill out a demo request. Welcome back to the second part of this final episode in the first series of Human Resource Development Masterclass. I'm your host, Darren Short, and I'm looking through the 10 themes that I've identified from the series. We've already explored how we define ourselves, how we respond to the changing workplace, the shifting balance between organizational and individual responsibility, changes to how people learn, and HRD's role in advocating for social justice. The sixth theme that I identified from the series was that of HRD working across cultures. Let's listen to an extract from my conversation with Ahad Osmangani from episode 8 on cross-cultural HRD.
Unfortunately, there is a tendency to apply those models and frameworks in a wholesale manner in Asia or in any other countries outside North America and Europe. And to me, it is very dangerous. In a way, it might confuse the students, or it might have sometimes negative impact. So when I teach my courses in management area, in workshops and seminars, or in MBA classes, I always say that whatever you say, this is the book, this is the research, but don't swallow it. Take it, that is the God's word. We have to understand, we have to take a pinch of salt. You should be skeptical.
Throughout the series, we heard examples of HRD working in different countries and cultures and touched upon how HRD looks a little different in each location. In episode 1 with Dick Swanson and Linda Perriton, we explored the history of HRD from a US perspective and then compared that to a UK one. In episode 3, Gary McLean shared examples of working in Thailand, Bangladesh, and Saudi Arabia. In episode 6, Carol Elliott shared examples of critical HRD from the United Kingdom. And we heard from Yeonju Cho in episode 7 about the challenges of women leaders in Korea. Listening to those conversations reminded me of when I joined the Academy of Human Resource Development in the mid-90s. And in my first few conferences, I attended the pre-conference on globalization, each year attracting 50 to 60 attendees who were spending a day together focused on HRD issues associated with a more global economy. I suppose it's a sign of how far things have changed that I really don't bump into the topic of globalization much these days. And I suppose that has much to do with how working across national borders and across cultures has become more of the norm. Over the same time period, I've seen a change in our language too, which has shifted away from the term international HRD in favour of the term cross-cultural HRD, which was something that Ahad Osmangani spoke about in episode 8. What I found particularly interesting from the series was how several cross-cultural topics emerged that would have fit right into the discussions that we were holding 20 to 25 years ago, as if, in some respects, not much has changed. For example, Yeonju Cho in episode 7 talked about the challenges of a lack of indigenous HRD theories in Asia and how we still see Western theories being applied outside of North America and Europe. And we heard from Rozia Mohamed Rusty in episode 8 about the challenges of communicating across cultural boundaries, and from Ahad Osmangani in the same episode about how organizations still have a tendency to build training for one culture and then to export it to other cultures with minimal, or indeed sometimes with no, adaptation. Ahad spoke about the importance of HRD professionals developing competencies to work across cultures, and the importance of preparing for work in a different culture. And he also spoke about the important role that language plays in being able to communicate across cultures. As I re-listen to those conversations, I find myself thinking back to my own experiences of working in different countries. I've had the good fortune to do HRD work in around 20 countries, And I shake my head a little when I think about some of the rookie mistakes I made in my early years when heading off to a different culture to consult or do training. I probably made every mistake that Ahad and Rosia warned us about in episode 8, and I learned a lot about how not to do it. And so I really hope that organizations now do a better job of preparing HRD professionals for working outside of their own culture and put more energy into adapting HRD processes, products, and services to be effective in different cultures, including exploring the concept of cultural clusters that Ahad described. The seventh theme I identified across the first series was that of HRD becoming more strategic. Here's Thomas Garavan with an extract from our conversation in episode 10.
One of the other things about strategic HRD, it gives emphasis to the notion of alignment. And in this case, strategic alignment, or what we call vertical alignment. In other words, that the things that the HRD practitioner does day-to-day in organizations contribute to building the knowledge, skills, abilities, and behaviors and values that will best help the organization to realize its business strategy. Now, that all sounds great in theory. However, from my research down through the years, I've realized that many HRD practitioners don't have a great appreciation of the strategy in some cases, or a knowledge of it, or they are not in a position hierarchically or structurally within the organization where they can glean what current strategic thinking is. Because in many organizations, and especially in SMEs, which I've studied quite a bit, they may never articulate in a formal term what their business strategy is.
I recall reaching a point in my own career when I was suddenly being challenged to be more strategic and to develop strategies, and I really wasn't sure what that meant. Looking back now, I'm not sure whether that's because I'd been blind to the concept of strategy up to that point, or whether perhaps it was because I was part of a profession that had been. Maybe it was a combination of the two. Ever since then, in my practice, the need has been there to demonstrate value, align to business strategy, get a seat at the table where decisions are being made, get the ear of business leaders, and much more. As we heard from Ron Jacobs in episode 4, as well as both Thomas Garavan and Holly Hutchins in episode 10, a significant weight is placed on the importance of HRD being strategic, with that often being viewed as the key to being funded in organizations, as opposed to being defunded or outsourced. So what does it mean for HRD to be strategic? As we heard in episode 10, it often means making sure that HRD is focused on where it can most help the business to achieve its goals. And as I know from my own experience of leading HRD teams, that's far easier said than it is done, probably for several reasons. First, it isn't always clear what the business goals are. As Thomas Garavan described in episode 10, given where HRD sits in many organizations, it may only have a limited visibility into business priorities. Secondly, business priorities can change quickly, and HRD then finds itself having to pivot and change direction when much of what it does takes time to design, develop, and release. The faster organizations move, the more problematic it becomes for an HRD team that can't roll out solutions quickly, and HRD can then find itself half building everything and never releasing anything. Thirdly, it can be a challenge identifying the top priorities to work on when every part of the business has its own top priorities that they often view more important than everyone else's. So it's likely to be true that HRD can have a big impact by trying to move 5 things forward a mile rather than move 1,000 things forward a foot. However, actually getting agreement on the 5 things to focus on is tough. As we heard about in the 10 episodes, despite these challenges to HRD becoming strategic, there are clearly actions that HRD professionals can take to position themselves for greater strategic success. They can engage stakeholders in discussions on priorities and check back in with those stakeholders to make sure priorities aren't changing. They can implement rapid design and delivery methods. They can run A/B testing and pilots to ensure that HRD actions deliver results. And they can report impact data back to stakeholders. They can also work closely with partners around the organization so that HRD is a collaborative partner on strategic issues, rather than being viewed as an isolated service provider. The eighth theme that cut across the first series was that of demonstrating our worth. Now, I accept that I could have named this theme differently, but as I thought through the options for naming it, I found that I kept coming back to the concept of how we show stakeholders that we're adding value, and not only worth keeping around, but actually worth investing in. Before I dig deeper into this, let's hear an extract from my conversation with Karen Watkins from episode 2 on learning in organizations.
I think that for us, the real test is whether the learning is applied. Is it used? So if, you know, think about the game of golf. I can take a class, right? I can watch a video. I can take a, you know, I can work with a tutor. You know, I can practice with a video game. I still don't know golf. And, you know, it isn't really until I have used it out on a golf course again and again and again that I can clearly demonstrate that I've learned how to play golf. And I think that's the secret here for how to think about learning in human resource development. Our job is to create skills and knowledge that people can then apply in order to, you know, not only do a job better, but to, you know, help the organization become better. So it's changing that capacity.
The theme of demonstrating our worth appeared in several places and in different forms throughout the series. As we heard from Karen Watkins there, the real test of learning is whether it's applied. In episode 4, we heard from Ron Jacobs about the importance of us demonstrating our impact. Yet despite the importance of HRD doing this, the evidence appears to be that HRD really hasn't made great strides in the area of evaluation. In episode 9, we heard from Darlene Rosseft and Jay Kerr that HRD is often evaluated by gathering vast amounts of data, often through surveys, that really don't provide the evidence that stakeholders are looking for. Too often, HRD interventions are evaluated by focusing on activity and reaction rather than impact. And as Jay Kerr pointed out in episode 9, they're evaluated by the same people who designed and ran those interventions. And the work on evaluation typically starts too late in the process. In light of this, it's probably not surprising to hear Thomas Garavan in episode 10 talking about the challenges of researching causal links between investment in HRD and organizational performance. Just imagine how much stronger the business case for HRD would be if that evidence did exist, if we knew that an investment of X in HRD is returned Y-fold to the business. In the absence of that, we did hear good advice in the series about steps that HRD professionals can be taking to shift their evaluation in the right direction, including working with stakeholders at the outset around what evidence they're looking for to assess the impact of interventions, focusing evaluation efforts on programs that are strategically important to the business or represent a significant investment in time or money, around evaluating to understand not only what changes happen as a result of HRD actions, but also why those changes happen, and around focusing on evaluating a small number of cases in depth rather than gathering a large amount of data on everything. It feels like much can be gained by HRD professionals taking a fresh look at what they evaluate, who evaluates, and how they evaluate. And by doing this, to rethink their ways of demonstrating HRD's worth to an organization. The ninth theme from the first series was how HRD works through and with others. Let's hear from Kim McDonald and Raji Ghosh from episode 5 on career development.
Partnering with managers and making sure that managers know how to develop their employees, rewarding managers for how they develop employees are really important roles that HRD can play in the organization.
I couldn't agree more. Unless the managers, the leaders, share the responsibility of developing their employees, the culture of the organization will never become developmental. So it's not just the formal training, right? It is the informal learning that happens in day-to-day interactions. And that's where the leaders in the organization needs to think of developing others as a natural part of their job. And that's where the HRD professionals can really work to help the leaders understand that kind of shared responsibility.
With organizations being complex systems, it's very difficult to make an impact within an organization without working with other parts of the system. And this surfaced throughout the series. In particular, we heard most about the relationship between HRD and HRM, about the important role of line managers and leaders, the relationship that HRD has with stakeholders, and the increasingly important role of allies and employee resource groups. Of all of these, perhaps the most complex relationship appears to be the one between HRD and HRM. For example, we heard from Linda Perriton in episode 1 about the blurring lines between HRM and HRD and a sense that HRM has encroached into the world of HRD. And from Kim McDonald in episode 5 about how HRD and HRM work together on career development within organizations. And we saw the same emphasis on collaboration when hearing from Marilyn Bird in episode 7 about how HRD and HRM work together on diversity. At the same time, the series also surfaced some of the challenges associated with the HRD and HRM relationship. Holly Hutchins in episode 10 spoke about the challenges of HRD often being part of an HR function that's managed by an HRM person. And so of HRD having to work through HRM. Holly also spoke about how HRD's approach to organizational problems is often different from that of HRM's. And Thomas Garavan, in the same episode, talked about the different strategic remits of HRD and HRM. I've seen this HRD-HRM relationship play out in different ways in organizations. That the skill sets and knowledge base are similar enough to feel part of the same family, but different enough to feel like they're perhaps cousins rather than siblings. However, in my experience, it's a rare setup where HRD doesn't find itself having to work closely with HRM. And so part of the key to success for HRD often comes from figuring out how to work with HRM, to partner on solving organizational problems and to bring their relative strengths to the table rather than emphasizing differences. One relationship that surfaced often in the series and where there appears to be consistent agreement on its importance is that of HRD partnering with managers and leaders. As we heard a few moments ago from Kim McDonald and Raji Ghosh in episode 5, managers have an important role to play in supporting employees with their career development. Then Karen Watkins, Victoria Marsick and Jelena Alston in episode 2 emphasized how managers, in particular, have a critical role to play as coaches, role models, and as Jelena stressed, mentors. In the same episode, Victoria Marsick emphasized the important role that middle managers can play as either supporters of learning and a learning culture or as barriers to it. So HRD has much to be gained from working closely with frontline managers, middle managers and leaders. With learning changing so much in our personal lives and in the workplace, more learning is happening outside of formal HRD programs. And so it's critical that HRD can work closely with managers and leaders as true partners. In the series, we also heard from Laura Beermer and Tamika Greer in episode 6, as well as Marilyn Bird in episode 7, about the increasingly important role that employee resource groups have in organizations. And so how important it is that HRD builds close relationships with them, leverages them to understand the diverse learning needs within an organization, and also explores how those groups can support the rollout of learning strategies. However we look at the series, the message comes through clearly that HRD needs to be effective at building and leveraging relationships within organizations, with employees, employee groups, managers, leaders, and stakeholders. And as Holly Hutchins explored in episode 10, there's much to be gained from HRD education featuring this as a key role in programs for HRD professionals. The final theme that cut across the first series was that of the gap between HRD research and practice. Here's an extract taken from my conversation with Richard Swanson from episode 1 on the history and foundation of HRD.
Is to articulate the underlying theory. What is it that describes this phenomena? And that theory ultimately has to match up with practice. Some fields don't have that dilemma. I mean, we're in a field that is an applied discipline, and as an applied discipline, we have to have integrity in both worlds, the academic world and in the applied world. So we need to have some angst about how the theory informs the practice and how the practice informs the theory. Most of us in the profession who have been active with applied research in the field, we work with organizations and practitioners, and sometimes we learn, well, I say sometimes, a lot of the time we learn about how things work before we can explain them. So we discover things in practice and then go, well, what's really going on here?
The gap between research and practice is an area I focused on a lot over the last 20 years. I chaired a committee of what was then ASTD and is now ATD on research to practice. I've organized pre-conferences exploring the topic and written journal articles. And so it's particularly interesting to me to look at the state of HRD research and practice now compared to what it was 20 years ago. Back in episode 1, we heard from Dick Swanson about how practice is often viewed as being filled with fads not validated by research. He also spoke about how HRD has a much more substantial body of knowledge now coming out of research, but that knowledge isn't easily accessible by practitioners, and about how much performance improvement happens within organizations without HRD involvement. In the same episode, Linda Perriton talked about how academics are not the first people called to help organizations, how researchers have been sidelined, and how HRD departments have increasingly become commissioners of outsourced interventions that are typically driven by the latest fad. Similar issues were surfaced by Toby Egan in episode 3 and Ron Jacobs in episode 4, and by Darlene Rosseft in episode 9 when describing how HRD practitioners continue to look to Kirkpatrick when designing evaluation approaches. All of which points to continuing challenges that HRD researchers face in influencing the world of HRD practice. That research is tough for practitioners to access, is written in a language that's difficult to decipher, and typically doesn't go into much detail on practical implications. It's therefore hardly surprising that Kirkpatrick survives in the world of HRD evaluation when it's easy to wrap your head around, easy to explain to someone else, and easy to put into practice. As a result, it can be tough to view HRD as a profession when most of the people who claim an HRD professional title are practicing without really understanding what works or why it works. So there's much that HRD research and theory can do to legitimize the HRD profession and to validate approaches to HRD. We heard from several people, including Dick Swanson, Ron Jacobs, and Thomas Garavan, about how researchers working with practitioners offer a way forward. A way of researchers better understanding the priorities and realities of the workplace, while adding to the knowledge base and also feeding research and theory into the world of practice. We also heard from Tamika Greer in episode 6 and Holly Hutchins in episode 10 about how education has a key role to play in sharing the knowledge base of HRD with practitioners who can then use that knowledge in their own work and feed it through into the HRD teams they're a part of. So through partnerships and collaboration, and also through education, the worlds of HRD research and practice can get closer together. However, more is needed. For example, interpreting HRD research for the world of practice. And so finding the nuggets of information that would benefit practice, and then sharing those nuggets in ways that practitioners can find them, understand them, and leverage them. As we continue to explore the fundamentals of HRD in our next series, it'll be helpful for us all to look for examples of where HRD is doing this well and to learn from those examples. So there are my 10 themes that surfaced as I listened back through the first series of Human Resource Development Masterclass. As I look forward to the second series that releases later this year, I'll definitely carry those 10 themes with me and see how they change as we explore different aspects of HRD. Something else I'll carry with me are 5 extracts from the first series that I find myself returning to multiple times. It's strange how that happens in life, that through all of the noise and all of the information that our minds are bombarded with every minute of every day, that somehow something is said that makes a mind stop and reflect. And my mind has been returning back to a few of these over and over again because something was said that was intriguing and that can't be ignored. And I have 5 short examples from the first series that I want to play for you, in the hope that hearing them again gives you a chance to also pause, like I've done, and sit with these statements for a while. Up first, you'll hear from Linda Perriton from Episode 1 on the history and foundation of HRD.
I look around, even a fairly advanced industrial economy like the one I live in, and I don't see well-trained people. I don't see exceptional service. I don't see exceptional levels of competence in fairly even routine roles in society. So if we've cracked large parts of human resource development, I don't trip over the evidence of it on a day-to-day basis. I have absolutely no doubt that we have thoughtful, well-educated practitioners in some areas of society and of industry working really quite hard and doing good things. But I don't think we have made a breakthrough in terms of, if we do know stuff, we're keeping it secret, it seems to me, in terms of what I see out there.
My second example comes from Jelena Alston from Episode 2 on learning in organizations.
It is critical for organizations to never forget that adult learners occupy the workspace, right? These are adult learners. They're not just colleagues. They're not just employees. They're not just supervisors. They're not just leaders, right? They are adult learners. And so when we think about that, right, in learning within organizations, all organizations have some type of training, some type of continuing education, some type of professional development, some type of learning platform, et cetera, right? So when organizations do not recognize colleagues as adult learners, it's almost like a self-inflicted wound.
Next, you'll hear from Ron Jacobs from Episode 4 on training and development.
That if you ask the employees not what training technologies did you experience, but if you ask them, how did you learn how to do your job? That's a completely different question. When those kind of studies are reported, they almost never, ever refer to a training program that was delivered in a classroom or anything like that. Unfortunately, when you've asked people, how did you learn how to do your job? Almost invariably, they say, I learned how to do my job at the job and during the time I was doing my job. And so you know, there oftentimes is a disconnect between the things that we hold that are important, that we believe are important, of making sure what the future trends and, you know, making sure that we're plugged in with the latest technologies and things like that. And then when you ask people on the receiving end, well, how did you learn what you're doing? They give you a completely different answer with a completely different emphasis.
My next example is from Laura Biermer from episode 6 on Critical HRD.
The challenge really is for everyone listening to ask that question about how am I contributing to a humanly sustainable organization or household or workplace or community. And if you can't answer that question, then perhaps the next question is, how can I do better at being that person who's going to make, you know, my life and work more humanly sustainable? And I'm hoping that everyone who's engaged in this work of HRD is asking themselves those critical questions.
Finally, you'll hear from Marilyn Bird from episode 7 on diversity, equity, and inclusion in HRD.
I'm going to be candidly open and say that I really prefer not to just speak about diversity. I much prefer to talk about social justice, because I believe that social change and social justice are the outcome that we should be looking for. So the end goal or the end state is that we should be striving for in our workplaces is social justice. My philosophy of diversity, equity, and inclusion, and then ultimately social justice, is one of moral duty. The question that I believe that we should be looking for is, or trying to answer is, why are people being treated unjustly?
I hope that one or more of those 5 extracts prove to be helpful in your own reflection and as you continue your own HRD journey. And with all 5 still rumbling around in your mind, I'd like to thank our episode sponsor, Interpretive Simulations, and suggest that you find out more about them by visiting interpretive.com. I'd like to wrap up this episode by returning back to something I said near the start. Here are my words from roughly an hour ago. No matter how I look at the 10 episodes, it's tough to listen to them without thinking about the wonderful potential that exists within HRD. That within all of the breadth and depth, there's the skill set, the mindset, and the knowledge to really make a difference for the better in this world. If you take anything from this first series, I really hope it's a desire to do just that. To use your HRD skill set, mindset, and knowledge to go out there and make a difference for the better in this world. Wherever I look, I see places where HRD can make a difference. And I really hope that we do. Thank you for listening to this first series. It's been an honor to spend time with you, and I hope that we'll be together again for the second series when it launches later this year. Until then, stay safe. This is Darren Short signing off from the Human Resource Development Masterclass. HRD Masterclass Podcast is brought to you by the Academy of Human Resource Development and is a production of allbypodcast.com.